From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In some circles, the Congressional Budget Office scorecard of the Republican health care plan landed yesterday with about as much welcome as today's March snow. The report by the nonpartisan CBO concluded that the American Health Care Act, by doing away with the mandate that everyone buy insurance or be fined, would reduce budget deficits by $337 billion over a decade and lower premiums for some, but it would greatly boost others, and it would increase the number of uninsured people by 24 million, higher than expected. This morning, President Trump's budget director, Mick Mulvaney, went on CNN to push back and answer the question, is the GOP in damage control?
The CBO report is full of errors. Not errors, they're just bad assumptions like that. It's the only way you can get to these bizarre numbers. So I don't think it's damage control as much as laying out to people exactly what we thought would happen. The CBO doesn't do a very good job at counting coverage.
Joining us, NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, not all Republicans were on board with the plan and are on board with the White House response to the CBO. So what are you hearing?
That's right. The conservatives don't like what the CBO says about the cost of the tax credits that are included in the program. The moderates are really staggered by that figure of 24 million fewer people with health insurance by the year 2026. The moderates are a bigger force in the Senate. People like Senator Tom Cotton in Arkansas, which has seen a real improvement in its health insurance status under the Affordable Care Act, are really dubious about something that's going to throw this big a monkey wrench into the works.
Look, House Speaker Paul Ryan keeps framing this as, 24 million people uninsured as choice, that people will be uninsured because they choose not to be insured. And then there's a sense that people might, not have the mandate to buy it, so they don't buy it. But then when they need it, it's going to be a lot more expensive. So talk about that, how that argument's going, that this is choice.
House Speaker Paul Ryan has always been more straightforward about what the GOP's intention is with this repeal and replace measure. He has said all along, we're not going to try to compete with the Affordable Care Act on coverage. There's no way we're going to cover as many people as the Affordable Care Act did. I think he was maybe surprised that the CBO came out with a figure as big as 24 million who would go without coverage under this plan compared to the Affordable Care Act. But he's never suggested that the Republicans would try to cover everyone. President Trump, on the other hand, has said repeatedly, we're going to have great coverage for everybody. It's going to be cheaper. It's going to be something great. He's been vague about what it would be, but he has written much bigger checks with his campaign than Paul Ryan ever did. And so in some ways, this report is more damaging. It's a bigger challenge, a bigger rebuke to the promises that President Trump has made than to the promises that Paul Ryan made.
Well, and what happens going forward when the two are going to have to work together to hammer this out, especially since we just got this newly released audio tape? It was released on the conservative website Breitbart, of course, with ties to Steve Bannon, who is now Trump's top advisor. It's audio of Speaker Ryan in an October conference call with Republicans right after the tape of then-candidate Trump came out talking about grabbing women. And here's Ryan.
I am not going to defend Donald Trump. Not now, not in the future. As you probably heard, I just invited him from my first congressional district GOP event this weekend, a thing I do every year. And I'm not going to be campaigning with him over the next 30 days. Look, you guys know I have real concerns with our nominee.
Look, the Breitbart news site has been one of the biggest defenders of Donald Trump. Why would they put that old audio tape out today?
That's a very good question. I mean, in a way, it's not surprising that Paul Ryan said what he said at that time when Donald Trump was very toxic and even his vice presidential running mate, Mike Pence, was keeping him at arm's length. But it is certainly surprising to see this come out now. Whether it's designed to drive a wedge between the president and the House Speaker, who knows? But it is certainly a curious timing of that release.
Look, one last question. Premiums. The CBO found that premiums after financial assistance for a 64-year-old earning $26,500 would skyrocket from $1,700 to $14,600 a year.
Yeah, Paul Ryan seized on the CBO's finding that over the long term, healthcare premiums on average would go down, but that doesn't mean they'd go down for everybody. Young, healthy people would see maybe cheaper insurance and skimpier insurance, but people in their 50s and 60s would likely be paying a lot more, especially in rural parts of the country where health insurance tends to be more expensive, and those are disproportionately Trump voters.
Is this thinking that 64-year-old would then be dumped into Medicare in a year anyway, so it
Well, if you're 64, you might be able to hold out till you get Medicare at 65. But if you're 51, 52, that's a long time to wait. And the expectation is that while the overall number of people buying insurance on the exchanges or in the individual market would only drop by about 2 million, it would be a change in the mix, and you would see more young, healthy people, which is good, but the older people who really need health insurance would be less likely to get it coverage.
Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent on what the CBO is saying about the Republican health care plan. Scott, thank you.
My pleasure.
The public school system in Gary, Indiana, used to be one of that state's largest, and folks called it a model district. Among its graduates, a Nobel Prize economist, successful business leaders, and entertainers. But today, Gary is having trouble meeting payroll, and it's shutting down schools. Michael Puente from member station WBEZ explains what happened.
It's another busy day for students in Nikki Date's fifth grade class at Jefferson Elementary School in Gary, Indiana. As they do every year, the students here prepare for all important standardized tests.
Do the problem in your book. Group four is math fun.
And like every year, Date has her top students, like Diablo Edwards. Diablo is into school, but he also has a long list of favorites outside of class.
Joe. SpongeBob, dragons, cartoons.
Diablo, Dates, and everyone at Jefferson is doing their best to carry on as normal this year, as if it really was a regular school year. But it's not. Their school is slated to close in June, not because Jefferson Elementary is doing poorly, but because Gary School District is running out of money.
The morale is low right now, and we're doing everything we can to conduct business as usual.
Michael Buckner has been Jefferson's principal for 2 years. He's brought in parent volunteers and other resources to keep students motivated and to improve behavior. Now, his school is going to close. Jefferson is just the latest Gary public school to face closure over the decades. Back in the 60s, Gary had 40,000 students in nearly four dozen schools. Today, there are less than 6,000 public school students. The city also has a dozen and a half school buildings to maintain, but fewer tax dollars to keep them running. Just last fall, voters narrowly rejected a last-ditch effort for a property tax increase to pay off Gary Public School System's $101 million debt.
The Gary School Corporation, as we all know, is experiencing unprecedented financial crisis unlike any school corporation has experienced in the state of Indiana.
Indiana State Senator Eddie Melton is a Democrat from Gary. He spoke at a recent state Senate committee. Melton and other Hoosier lawmakers are searching for solutions for Gary, things like loan forgiveness, increased funding, or maybe a fiscal monitor. But none will solve Gary's underlying problem, population loss. Since the late 1960s, nearly 100,000 people have left Gary for good. Only about 80,000 residents remain. Gary has been bleeding industry and businesses for decades, and that's drained the taxes the city needs to run a healthy school system. And now there's more public charter schools than ever to compete with.
There is a connection between the proliferation of charter schools and the need to stabilize the Gary Community School Corporation.
That's Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson speaking to that same state Senate committee. She says every child who leaves the Gary schools for a charter takes with them tax dollars that Gary could spend on its own schools. In 2006, Gary schools had about 12,000 students. Today, just half of that. Another 5,500 students are enrolled in charter schools. Freeman Wilson wants the state to impose a moratorium on new charter schools.
I believe in school choice. I think our job right now is to make sure that every choice that a parent has is a viable and a quality choice. And right now that means working to shore up the traditional public school corporation in the city of Gary.
Indiana's new state school superintendent, Jennifer McCormick, says some districts are working well with charters, but
there are some communities that are doing that better than others. But because of the financial situation around the state, you know, we're going to have to be good partners with traditional public schools and then public charters and the non-pubs.
Back at Jefferson Elementary, Principal Buckner is holding out hope that his school could stay open.
But I truly believe if we can really make a turnaround and show higher test scores and better behavior for the kids, they may have to reconsider.
So you feel that there's a chance they could reconsider?
I'm hoping and praying that for that to happen, absolutely.
Fifth grader Diablo Edwards puts a positive spin on his school's likely closing.
On the bright side, it's always good to go to another school, see what it's like.
If Indiana State lawmakers don't come up with a plan, Diablo is likely to attend sixth grade at a different elementary school somewhere in Gary. For Here and Now, I'm Michael Puente.
In 1796, President George Washington and First Lady Martha Washington lived in the nation's capital, then Philadelphia. Washington's presidency would end the next year, and the first family were making plans to return to their Mount Vernon estate. The Washingtons owned slaves, and they'd planned to return to Virginia with the slaves they'd held at the president's mansion. But 22-year-old Ona Judge didn't want to return to Virginia. She wanted her freedom. So in May 1796, Judge escaped the Washingtons. She found her way to New England and made a place for herself in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The Washingtons, though, they pursued Judge, but never captured her. However, it wasn't for want of trying, because in the waning days of his presidency, Washington used the full force of the federal government to try to return her to slavery, but he failed. And he continued to pursue Judge, unsuccessfully, until his death. Historian Erica Armstrong Dunbar tells this story in her new book, Never Caught: The Washingtons' Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. Dunbar is a professor of Black Studies and History at the University of Delaware, and when I spoke with her recently, I asked her to tell us more about Ona Judge.
Ona was one of hundreds of enslaved people who were born or brought to Mount Vernon. She, I think important to note is that she was technically the property of Martha Washington. Mm-hmm. Her mother had come from Martha Washington's first husband's estate. And so Martha Washington came to Mount Vernon, brought Ona's mother, Betty, with her. And Betty would go on to have some kind of encounter or relationship with a white indentured servant named Andrew Judge, and their encounter resulted in the birth of Ona. And Ona was born at Mount Vernon at the age of 10. She went up to the mansion house to serve Martha Washington and sort of moves up in the ranks and becomes basically Martha Washington's top slave.
Mm.
And she would also sort of take on the responsibilities of being a seamstress and a spinner, but she would do the most kind of intimate chores, helping Martha Washington bathe, brush her hair, fix her clothing. She knew her mistress well.
Yeah. Well, in 1789, after George Washington becomes president, the first president, you write in your book that Martha actually reluctantly joins him in the then first capital, which was New York. We're changing capitals a lot here in the early days of the country. What was that reluctance all about?
Yeah, she was. She referred to her days in the North actually as the lost days. She'd shared her husband with the nation for years during the American Revolution, and she worried about George Washington's health, and she didn't want to leave Virginia. She wanted to stay, and so she had no kind of control over her ability to stay. And so Washington actually goes to his own inauguration alone.
Huh. Well, I guess maybe what I should have asked more specifically is, given that they were slave owners, both in New York, but maybe especially in Philadelphia, things are complicated regarding like Philadelphia as a city and slavery. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there were differences clearly between New York and Philadelphia, and I think the Washingtons really kind of run into a roadblock with slavery when they come to Philadelphia. The nation's capital moves again in 1790, and the Washingtons take 9 enslaved people with them to Philly. And the laws of Pennsylvania say that you can't hold an enslaved person there. If you're a non-resident, you can't bring your slaves with you for longer than 6 months. And if you do, they have the opportunity to find freedom. So George and Martha and their secretary, Tobias Lear, purposefully rotate their slaves in and out of Pennsylvania. They write to each other that they want to keep it discreet. So he's not actually breaking the law, but he's definitely breaking the spirit of the law. So he would rotate Ona Judge and her other enslaved companions every 6 months back to Virginia or to New Jersey if a trip to Virginia was too difficult.
Now, when Ona was in Philly, did she see, do we know if she saw firsthand? There were free blacks living in the city at the time.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Philadelphia was the epicenter for black freedom and had more free blacks than anywhere else. Yeah, she saw it in the streets. She saw black entrepreneurs. She saw Richard Allen building Mother Bethel Church around the corner. There was no way to keep her from that. She saw it.
I mean, I cannot imagine the, I don't even know what to call it, the internal conflict, crisis, sense of what do you call it when you know you are being kept an enslaved person and you see the possibility of your liberation just right there on the street every day when you leave the house with the person who's your owner.
Yeah, I think that it shows the complexity of slavery, right? It's that Ona Judge would live 7 years in the North and really came of age at this moment from the age of 16 to really 22 or so. And she sees black freedom around her. She also sees white men and women being paid a wage. So there's a wage labor system that's now in place. And it affects her and it helps pull the trigger on her decision to free herself, or at least to steal herself from the Washingtons.
Wow. And so when and how did she decide then to pursue her freedom?
She finds out that she's going to be given away. She's going to be given away as a wedding gift to Martha Washington's granddaughter, a woman who was about the same age and who was known for having a kind of volcanic temper. And that decision, that change in her ownership, in addition to her experiences in a free North, made Ona make the decision, I just cannot stomach my enslavement anymore. And she turns to a free black community in Philadelphia for help.
Yeah. Wow. And how does she make her way to Portsmouth?
Then? Yeah. So she luckily for us, Ona leaves behind two interviews at the end of her life. And she tells us in these interviews that it's the free black community of Philadelphia that helps plan her trip. She says while the Washingtons were packing their things to go on their summer trip, she was packing her things to go too. She didn't know where. But eventually the free black community would help her. She doesn't give names because it's a federal crime to help or aid a fugitive slave. The only name she gives us is the name of the ship captain, John Bowles, who I was able to trace his ship into the port of Philadelphia in May of 1796. She gives us his name in her interview because he's deceased. She tells us that they were the ones, that it's the free black community and John Bowles who ferries her to freedom or a semblance of freedom in Portsmouth.
Mm. There's so much more I want to cover with you, and we're fast running out of time. I'm getting greedy now. But, you know, it's easy to at a distance to try to paint a life of in freedom as one of a grand transformation of that's so much better. And, of course, by definition, it has to be better because she was no longer enslaved. But was her life any easier in Portsmouth?
Yeah, I think it's actually, I mean, a decision not to use the term free or freedom in the title of the book. The book is called Never Caught for a reason, because Ona was actually never free.
Okay.
And what the book does is dismantle this myth about what freedom in the North supposedly was. Ona would live for half of a century as a fugitive, constantly looking over her shoulder and really forced to live a life of poverty and great hardship. But she says in her interviews, she would do it all again, that it was worth it, that the material goods meant nothing.
So tell me more about this, you know, half a century living as a fugitive. And for much of that time, or part of that time at least. I mean, it's the president of the United States who's using all the all that's at his disposal in terms of the power of the federal government to chase her.
Yeah, he turns to the Secretary of the Treasury. He turns to customs collectors in Portsmouth. And all of this, by the way, is documented by Washington's own hand. So these are, this is me using his words.
And so what does he say?
He says, go get her. He says, you know, my wife is very desirous of seeing her again, and I'd like you, we're going to do this under the most discreet, quiet manner possible. Go get her, and for as little cost as possible as well. And what's so interesting here is that it's a moment where George Washington clearly does break the law. He breaks the fugitive slave law, which set into action a process, a procedure in returning the enslaved who were fugitives. Lawyers and magistrates were to be involved, and Washington wanted none of that.
Hmm. And this is a pursuit that he maintained until he died.
Pretty much. He dies unexpectedly in December of 1799. We have correspondence that says up until September, he's still pursuing her.
Wow. So, but did his death then proffer Ona true freedom?
No, it doesn't, because the thing to remember is that Ona was actually the property of Martha Washington.
Yeah.
And while we know that George Washington emancipates his slaves in his will following the death of Martha, Martha sets no one free. So none of the property passed down from her first husband to her grandchildren or anyone she bought outright was ever free. So while Ona would have known that the president had died, she also knew that it didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
It did not set her free. And so even though we have not come across accounts of people going after her, she lived with the understanding that she was someone else's property, and any children that she had were also fugitives.
Historian Erica Armstrong Dunbar's new book is Never Caught: The Washingtons' Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson, and I want you to take a minute right now to think about the people you love. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know how to download a podcast, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a whole new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag tripod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
Intel is buying the Israeli company Mobileye for $15 billion. As the Wall Street Journal writes, it's the latest bet on a vision of cars as computers on wheels. Mobileye specializes in technology for self-driving cars, and Intel is the latest Silicon Valley company, along with Uber and Google, getting in on that market. What Intel CEO Brian Krzanich says is one of the most important and fastest-growing markets. Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal joins us from New York. Jason, weathering the storm. Thank you so much.
Hi, Robin.
This deal, second largest in Intel's history, it's huge for them. So remind us what a chip maker wants with Mobileye.
What they want with Mobileye? Well, Mobileye has grown into really one of the hottest names in the auto supply industry because they've got this technology known as Advanced Driver Assistance Systems, or ADAS. And so this deal would give Intel ownership of a technology that is key to computer-assisted driving, gives them a long list of customer relationships, and it also gets them in the race to create autonomous vehicles.
Autonomous vehicles, self-driving. Now, Mobileye, as you say, they have a lot of automakers as customers, General Motors, Honda, Volkswagen. So Intel is kind of buying those relationships.
Yeah, exactly. And they're, you know, buying into, and they're planning to supplement and work with mobile, you know, have their technologies work together. You know, the mobile eye technology, what it's able to do is it can see, understand the space around it, make sure the car stays in its lane. And Intel says that its chips are already, you know, that its chips can work with mobile eye technology in the cloud to help you and use artificial intelligence to help make mobile eyes data even smarter, help it make smarter decisions. And, you know, mobile eyes chips are already installed in more than 300 car models.
But there are questions. Remember, Mobileye worked with Tesla, and that relationship ended after that public disagreement over the terrible fatal accident in May. Just remind us.
Yeah. That relationship went south. We were talking about that Tesla Model S. It was last May, fatal car crash. And what appears to have happened, according to Tesla, is that the Mobileye system failed to distinguish a white trailer of a truck that cut in front of the car from the bright sky.
Right.
You know, Mobileye said the system isn't designed to always detect vehicles in front of it, but its new system that's coming, the IQ4, would be able to do so. But Elon Musk says that they've shifted their emphasis to radar over cameras, and they said that might have saved the life of Joshua Brown, who died.
Oh, yeah, driving without even braking. Look, we're going to take this up another time. I always wonder if there's going to be a backlash against more technology in the car. I'm one of those people that can't even stand what I already have. It's just too distracting. But we just want to mention, too, automakers in Detroit are pushing forward along with Uber and Google. Just remind us.
That's right. I mean, most of the major automakers, they've got programs devoted to self-driving cars, doing the R&D. Most of them are joined up with Israeli startups. Israel is where it's really happening with the research and development. Chrysler, they decided to outsource their self-driving program to Alphabet's Waymo. That used to be known as the Google Car Project.
Yeah. Well, but Intel teaming up with Mobileye, we'll see where that goes. Jason Bellamy of The Wall Street Journal, thanks as always.
You bet.
Food rescue has become a big deal with groups like, well, Food Rescue in Indianapolis and Chicago. Here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we have Food for Free, groups that salvage food that would go to waste at restaurants or stores. But what if there was a little food rescue at school? There is something called Share Tables in about 400 schools where kids can put the milk containers and fruit they don't want to be picked up by kids who do. The USDA endorses Share Tables, but notes that some local codes might be more restrictive, and that is now the case in Connecticut. That state is enforcing new rules on Share Tables, limiting what's allowed, including things not commercially packaged or meat, cheese, and milk. And that brings us to our first guest, 14-year-old Nick Iannone. He launched a Share Table this year. He's an eighth grader at James H. Moran Middle School in Wallingford, Connecticut. And Nick, how are you feeling about these new restrictions?
Well, I'm a little bummed out because they're wanting us to eliminate half the stuff that's on our food share tables. But the USDA actually encourages the use of food share tables, and they'd like us to have as much stuff on the food share tables for other students to take as they can.
So what's not allowed?
Most of our school's fruit and snack items are packaged within our lunchroom, like raisins, pears, carrots, fruit cups, apples, anything like that cannot be shared on the food share tables.
Because it is packaged at your school, so if it were commercially packaged and sealed, it would be allowed. I have to ask you, Nick. You know, there were all these moves to get some of these healthier snacks and things onto trays, and we were hearing that kids didn't want them. Are you saying that, yes, there are kids who don't want them, they put them out on the table, but other kids were taking them?
Yeah, so students that are maybe less fortunate than others, don't have a lunch or a snack at school lunch, they can come up and take fruit, or we've seen things like chips and yogurt come off the tables. So they're free to take anything that they want off the tables and put on.
Well, what a great idea. I'm just, you know, wondering a little more, is that a stigma at all in school? I mean, if you have a table there and everybody can see who goes up, or do kids not seem to mind?
I haven't seen any problems with it. Most kids usually just stay within their friend group and talk amongst themselves. No one really cares what happens, what goes on around the food table.
Huh. You're saying that kids were happily putting things like cartons of milk and the snacks they didn't want on the table.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so now we have these restrictions. Let's bring in John Williamson, who is the president of Food Rescue. They're based in Indiana. And John, you've been working with schools to reduce food waste. Had you worked with Nick?
Yeah, so in 2016, we got an inquiry on our website from Tammy Araccio, who is on the Wallingford Parent Teacher Advisory Council, and we started working with them, several state officials and local health department officials, about how to implement these programs in Connecticut schools. And meanwhile, Nick was having these thoughts about getting things started, and they were able to successfully get started this year. So what we do as an organization is provide online resources and educational materials to inspire people to learn the truth about these, what the USDA says, what different states say about it, so that they can proceed with a lot of knowledge.
And knowledge seems to be key here, because it sounds like some of the schools or the districts or the state in this case, they're worried about liability. But as you and others point out, there is a law that covers that.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that is the 1996 Bill Emerson Good Samaritan Laws covered restaurants and grocery stores for donating perishable surplus food. But schools were really not certain whether that covered them or not. So in November of 2011, it was clarified that schools actually do have the same protections that the other businesses have for donating surplus perishable food. And that protects them up to the standard of gross negligence.
Well, and Nick, you know what the adults are saying in your state, those who are passing these restrictions. They are worried that, let's say, a container of milk might have gone bad, or that a student might get sick from this food.
My thought on it is, if it's commercially packaged and it's kept refrigerated, if necessary, there's no reason it should be bad.
Yeah. Well, why'd you do this? How'd you come to start this? What was your thinking?
So I was part of the Moran Middle School pilot program for Capstone. So basically, we were tasked with finding a problem within our Moran community. That's my middle school in Wallingford. So we had to find a problem within our Moran community and solve it using the Dream Design Do process, which Wallingford Public Schools has trademarked.
Wow.
And I mean, I immediately knew what I was going to do, and that was obviously food waste in the cafeteria.
Why so obvious?
Just every day. I have a lot of my peers at my school. They take hot lunch, and I can tell that none of them really eat their raisins, drink their milk, or keep their carrots. Most of it goes to the trash.
Yeah. So you were seeing that. And you might also have been seeing, we understand there are 1,300 students eligible for free or reduced price lunch. That's something like 22% of the district population in Wallingford. So were you also seeing kids that you thought maybe didn't have enough to eat?
Originally, that wasn't the idea, but that was definitely a benefit of the food table as it grew.
Yeah. Well, we understand you've got a donated refrigerator at the school that will keep yogurt and milk that's designated for sharing cold. We know school officials have inquired about a waiver to the new policy. But meantime, what would you want people to know, Nick, about the sharing table?
I mean, getting the word out is my main goal right now, and getting people involved with the food table and putting stuff on it in the schools would be awesome.
Okay. John Williamson, what would you want people to know, especially people who are worried about liability?
I just would love them to know that the USDA has thought very carefully about this issue, and they've implemented food safety guidelines so that it would be safe, so that we don't feed landfills instead of children. It makes no sense at all in our country that 1 in 6 are hungry while 40% of our food is wasted. And we waste in our schools these unopened and unpeeled items like Nick has been trying to rescue. We waste 1 billion of those items each year in our country, and it's just absurd. And there are guidelines to follow. And we need to start a grassroots movement of just educating people on the food safety standards that the USDA has put out that are perfectly legitimate and well thought out.
Well, it seems like there can be some other education here. We're talking about schools. There might be an awareness, like Nick was starting to notice waste. There might be empathy, noticing that somebody else doesn't have the food that you don't want, and so it could go to good use.
Yeah, I think it teaches children to be thankful for what's been provided for them. I think it teaches them to understand that food has a nutritional value. You know, we tell students that that food has a nutritional value, but then we tell them, no, just go ahead and throw an unopened milk or an unpeeled apple or orange. Just throw it right there in the trash can. It really doesn't matter. So it really sends a mixed message. And with what Food Rescue is doing by making students like Nick the face of this issue, we allow them to actually tell the story, and they actually learn entrepreneurial skills as well about sharing a story and watching impact grow.
Mm. Yeah, we're, you know, Nick, scared of you. by the way, what do you want to do? You're only 14, but do you have a sense of what you want to do in life?
I thought a lot about joining the military. I think this and the whole food share table, it's really teaching me good leadership skills, and I think that'd be great.
Yeah, well, so do we. That's Nick Iannone. He's an eighth grader at James H. Moran Middle School in Wallingford, Connecticut, and he launched the Share Table there. John Williamson, president of Food Rescue, the group that works with schools to reduce food waste, and they do so much more. We'll link you to Food Rescue as well. John, Nick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Just want to say again that Nick is 14. 14. Okay, quick update on the weather. As today's nor'easter makes its way up the East Coast, I have turned buckets over the port. Tulips, we'll see if that works. New York City is getting less snow than initially forecast. Temperatures have risen and the snow has changed over to sleet in some places. Forecasters now say New York City will get about 4 to 6 inches of snow, not the 18 to 20 that were forecast. That's going to western Massachusetts and parts of upstate New York, inland Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine. Nearly 250,000 customers have lost power from Virginia on north thanks to that wet, heavy snow and high winds. Airlines have canceled more than 6,000 flights. Amtrak has suspended service. So has the post office in some areas. Southwest Airlines, which carries more domestic passengers than any other airline, won't operate any flights today at 14 airports from Washington to Portland, Maine, so check ahead. And the trouble at airports won't end as quickly as the storm. The airlines have already canceled another 650 flights for Wednesday. According to the tracking company FlightAware, that number will likely rise. But Josh, I do not think you're going to have off from school tomorrow. Do your homework. It's here and now.
The British Parliament has passed the Brexit bill, moving Britain one step closer to triggering Article 50 and withdrawing from the European Union. But one complication. Yesterday, Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon said she'd call for a second referendum on Scottish independence from the UK to keep Scotland in the EU. The BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson joins us. And Rob, it's good to have you.
Nice to be with you again.
First of all, explain to us what the significance of the vote that the Parliament took yesterday is, if any.
Oh, it's hugely significant. It's a historic moment indeed, in that firstly, it actually just gives Theresa May, the Prime Minister, the power to begin that two-year process for Britain to leave the European Union, that negotiation. But secondly, quite interestingly, it also demonstrated the Prime Minister's current, and I stress that, current political mastery, when you survey the British scene. I mean, think about how controversial this was, this legislation, and she got it through easily.
Hmm. Now, Prime Minister May has said that she's going to wait until the end of this month to trigger Article 50. We'll talk about exactly what Article 50 is in just a moment, but is there, what reason has she given for waiting a couple of weeks?
I think it's partly because of the surprise announcement about another Scottish referendum. I think it's partly sensitivity to some elections that there are in Europe, and of course sensitivity about the party towards the end of the month in Rome celebrating the birth of the European Union.
I see. Okay. So Article 50 then, I mean, this is the formal act of that a nation would take to unwind itself from the European Union, but it's never been done before. So what exactly happens when Article 50 is triggered?
You know, I'm made to think here of Homer Simpson, as in the famous engineer in the Great Simpsons program, where, you know, there's a time, there's an episode where he's looking at how a nuclear power plant is actually sort of structured and functioned, and he goes, "Don't! Who would expect it could be so complicated?"
Oh,
and I think it's a bit like that about Britain withdrawing from the EU. I mean, according to this Article 50 process, we now have 2 years to negotiate our way out of a relationship that's lasted over 40 years. And it's really worth stressing just how close that relationship is. I mean, people can move from any part of Europe to another. Goods and services can move. Capital can move. You know, not surprisingly, people have likened this to the biggest peacetime negotiation, biggest peacetime challenge that Britain has faced since 1945.
It's amazing when you think about all that has to be thought about, considered, and acted upon in 2 years, right? That's the timeline that's given once Article 50 is triggered. Are observers optimistic that all can be negotiated in just 2 years?
Well, look, on the one hand, you have the government, which not surprisingly is trying to say this could all be done. They're trying to sound as positive as possible. But an awful lot of retired diplomats and officials behind the scenes are saying they just think there's no way of doing this. And that what in most likelihood will happen is that there'll have to be an extension to the 2-year period. But of course, there's no guarantee that could happen. I mean, if you want to look at a sort of a doomsday scenario, it may be that lots of hardcore British Brexit politicians say, no, these negotiations aren't going well. Let's just leave, to hell with the Europeans. Or that the Europeans, who are very hurt by Britain leaving, might say, well, you know what, we don't want to give you a 2-year negotiation. You've created this problem. Tough luck. So, you know, there's a way, I guess, there's a spectrum. I mean, on the one hand, Meghna, if let's say there's a there's an ill wind, I mean, things could get really nasty very quickly. I mean, on the other hand, it may be that Britain and the European Union look at each other and say, right, let's try and do what's best for our economies and does the least damage to our peoples.
Well, we do need to touch upon the notion of a second Scottish referendum. So yesterday, Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon said she would call for a referendum, and here's some tape of her.
I will now take the steps necessary to make sure that Scotland will have a choice at the end of this process. A choice of whether to follow the UK to a hard Brexit or to become an independent country, able to secure a real partnership of equals with the rest of the UK and our own relationship with Europe.
So, Rob, a Scottish independence referendum failed back in 2014. Have things changed enough so that there's a possibility that Scotland could vote for its own independence this time around?
Well, look, I don't think there's any doubt that the very destiny and unity of the United Kingdom is at stake. I mean, the opinion polls tend to suggest that things would be very, very close if a referendum were called, right, let's say, by the end of this week. I mean, the opinion polls also suggest that things haven't changed that much. I mean, despite the fact that the vast majority of Scots voted to remain in the EU and are very angry with the rest of Britain for voting out, it's not clear that that's had a really profound shift. But I guess that the fundamental point is, I mean, there is just so much risk and uncertainty out there. This is a huge risk for the Scottish nationalists, but also, let's face it, a massive risk and a massive headache for the Prime Minister Theresa May, because to be the PM who lost a bit of the United Kingdom, I mean, that would finish her off.
Rob Watson, political correspondent for the BBC. Many thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.